let's give our attention and our interest to Samuel Blumenfeld. Welcome and thank you for coming.
Thank you, Wayne, for that very kind introduction. Sort of ironic for me to be standing on the stage of a public high school, since I have gained a reputation for being such a vocal critic of the public schools. But of course, this is public property, is it not? We pay taxes for these buildings, and they belong to the taxpayer. They belong to the citizens of this state, this community. Why 19th century America abandoned Christian schools in favor of public education? When I started writing Is Public Education Necessary in 1976, I wanted to find out why this country, born in freedom, adopted government-owned and operated education so early in its history. The whole idea of government-controlled education seemed to contradict everything about the origins of this country and the adherence of our founding fathers to a philosophy of freedom. What's more, our federal constitution makes no mention of education and has left the entire matter up to the citizens and the states. Indeed, if you stop and think about it, it becomes more and more obvious that if anything at all should be in private hands, it is the education of the young. It is hard to think of an enterprise or service less suited to government ownership or control than the education of children. In the first place, parental rights, preferences, and responsibilities take precedence over government interest in the raising and educating of children. And secondly, education is so deeply involved with moral values derived from religion that it is inevitable that government involvement in education would lead to unending conflict and confrontation with both parents and religion. And we have not even addressed the problems of cost and efficiency, which argue strongly against any government enterprise. Besides, what does the government know about children? What does it know about the art of teaching? What does it know about God or morality? What does it know about love, caring, and the nourishment of the intellect and the soul? The establishment histories of public education give the impression that public education was created to guarantee literacy for all, particularly the poor, and to maintain our great democratic society. Yet my research into the origins of public education revealed an entirely different story. For example, literacy was very high in America from the time of the earliest settlements in New England and Virginia right up to the establishment of the public schools in the 1840s and 50s. The early colonists, in their vast majority, were devout Christians who built their new society on the solid foundation of the Bible. Knowledge of the Bible required high literacy, and that is why the early colonists stressed education. In the Massachusetts Bay Colony, Harvard College was founded by Calvinists in 1636, only 6 years after the first settlement at Boston. The purpose of the college was to train up a learned clergy. That meant teaching Latin, Greek, and Hebrew in the wilderness to ensure the development of a society based on the highest spiritual attainments that man was capable of. But it should be remembered that the Puritan leaders were outstanding men of learning with a sophisticated knowledge of history, politics, and religion, and that their congregations were made up of men and women of deep religious faith. They were determined to create a Bible commonwealth in which men could live in complete obedience to God's word, away from the corrupting influences of the old world. In a way, the Puritans as a movement can be compared with today's homeschoolers, who are, for the most part, also men and women of deep religious faith, with a mission to impart knowledge and wisdom and biblical principles to their children. I'm sure that if Christian homeschoolers today migrated en masse to some wilderness where they could create a society of their own, the educational facilities of that society would soon outshine that of the culture they left behind. Why? Because the homeschoolers, like the Puritans, would build their education on the foundation of truth, while the public education of contemporary America is based on falsehood. In the Massachusetts Bay Colony, education was considered a parental responsibility. In fact, the very first education law in the New World, enacted by the colonists in 1642, required parents to exercise that responsibility. It read, quote, "For as much as the good education of children is of singular behoof and benefit to any commonwealth, and whereas many parents and masters are too indulgent and negligent of their duty in this kind, it is therefore ordered by this court and the authority thereof that the selectmen of every town shall have a vigilant eye over their brethren and neighbors, to see first that none of them shall suffer so much barbarism in any of their families as not to endeavor to teach by themselves or others their children and apprentices as much learning as may enable them perfectly to read the English tongue." Hear that, perfectly to read the English tongue. "And knowledge of the capital laws upon penalty of 20 shillings for each neglect therein. Also, that all masters of families do, once a week at least, catechize their children and servants in the grounds and principles of religion," unquote. Thus, homeschooling was not only encouraged, it was required, unless you wanted to hire a tutor. The curriculum consisted of learning to read and the tenets of religion. Undoubtedly, in those days, most families normally provided their children with home instruction. The law was obviously enacted to make sure that some parents did not neglect that important duty. In 1647, 5 years later, a second law was enacted to promote education even further. That law read, quote, "It being one chief project of that old deluder Satan to keep man from the knowledge of the scriptures, as in former times, keeping them in an unknown tongue," meaning Latin. "So in these latter times, by persuading from the use of tongues, so that at least the true sense and meaning of the original might be clouded and corrupted with false glosses of deceivers, and to the end that learning may not be buried in the grave of our forefathers, in church and commonwealth, the Lord assisting our endeavors, it is therefore ordered by this court and authority thereof, that every township within this jurisdiction, after the Lord hath increased them to the number of 50 householders, shall then forthwith appoint one within their town to teach all such children as shall resort to him to write and read, whose wages shall be paid either by the parents or masters of such children, or by the inhabitants in general by way of supply, as the major part of those who order the prudentials of the town shall appoint, provided that those who send their children be not oppressed by paying much more than they can have them taught for in other towns. And it is further ordered that where any town shall increase to the number of 100 families or householders, they shall set up a grammar school, the masters thereof being able to instruct youths so far as they may be fitted for the university. And if any other town neglect the performance hereof above 1 year, then every such town shall pay £5 per annum to the next such school till they shall perform this order." Unquote. Again, it was the parents who were required to carry out their educational responsibilities. The law did not require parents to deliver their children to the government or the state. It required, in towns consisting of over 50 householders, that parents hire someone to teach their children. It in no way precluded homeschooling. It required the inhabitants of the larger towns to create a grammar school for college preparation. Since Harvard had been founded in 1636, the leaders of the community decided that college preparatory schools were necessary to prepare promising youths for careers as clergymen and judges. Thus, a knowledge of Latin, Greek, and Hebrew were considered indispensable if one were to know the true sense and meaning of God's word and not be deluded by Satan. Today in our secular textbooks, the Puritans are caricatured as naively superstitious, wearing their quaint, simple clothes, and believing in such mythological creatures as witches and demons. But the truth is that the Calvinist worldview of the Puritans provided them with a superior understanding of reality, which enabled them to establish and sustain a flourishing and growing civilization on a new continent, a moral and cultivated society which then attracted thousands and thousands of new settlers. Historians have called Puritan New England a theocracy. To the extent that God's law ruled the Commonwealth, it was indeed a theocracy. True, only church members could vote or be elected to public office, but the church was democratic in form. Each congregational church elected its own minister, and there was no religious hierarchy. As Cotton Mather put it in one of his sermons, quote, "Let all mankind know that we came into the wilderness because we would worship God without that episcopacy, that common prayer, and those unwarrantable ceremonies with which the land of our forefathers' sepulchres has been defiled. We came because we would have our posterity settled under the pure dispensations of the gospel, defended by rulers that should be of ourselves." Unquote. It was in the framework of basic Calvinist worldview, that the American colonies grew. The development of trade, the influx of other religious sects and denominations, the increased economic prosperity, the emergence of religious liberalism, and the pressures of the British Crown and Anglican Episcopacy to dominate the colonies wrought major changes. But the essentials of Calvinist belief dominated colonial society. The Great Awakening, that intense evangelical revival that swept the American colonies in the 1730s and 40s, was not only an affirmation of that basic, uncluttered simplicity of man's relationship with God, but also a strong reaction against the growing liberalism of the clerical elite. The Awakening also enhanced the idea of individual freedom as a prerequisite for a religious life, an idea that helped fuel the American Revolution. Charles Lippe writes, quote, "Because the individual sinner became the center of religious experience, and because all persons as sinners held equal status before God, the importance of the individual in the structure of both religion and society was enhanced." Unquote. After the Revolution, The shift from common schools to private schools and academies did not signify a change in Christian consciousness. All schools were Christian schools in those days, for the simple reason that Americans still had a strong Christian consciousness and lived and worked within a Christian framework. The change from common school to private school represented a change in political form brought about by the Industrial Revolution, an expansion of knowledge, and the response of private initiative to new educational needs. Schools became places where not only basic skills and morals were taught, but also the many new professions and vocations. A learned clergy was still needed to provide spiritual leadership, and the glorification of God was still the purpose of life. But the economic possibilities of life, the opportunities to gain wealth, had expanded enormously, and the private school responded well to the changing needs of the new industrial era. It was in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s that the dominant Christian consciousness began to give way to an emerging secular worldview. What caused this change to take place? It began with the emergence of the Unitarian heresy in New England among the liberal clergy, the Harvard elite, and the affluent merchant class. The crucial event that signaled the arrival of the new worldview was the takeover in 1805 of Harvard University by the Unitarians and the expulsion of the Calvinists. That takeover not only made Harvard the citadel of religious and moral liberalism, but also the citadel of anti-Calvinism. It also set the stage for the philosophical conflict between the Christian and secular worldviews that still rages in America today. The issues at stake were fundamental: the nature of God and the nature of man. The Unitarians rejected Calvin's doctrines of innate depravity, predestination, election, and reprobation as repugnant and unjust. They rejected the Trinity as, quote, an enormous tax on human credulity, unquote. And by doing so, also rejected the divinity of Christ and the means of salvation provided by his sacrifice on the cross. They were also repelled by the idea of a sovereign, omnipotent God who permitted evil and suffering to exist and who saved some human beings and rejected others. As Unitarian leader William Channing put it in 1819, quote, "To give our views of God in one word, we believe in his parental character. Now we object to the systems of religion which prevail among us, that they are adverse in a greater or less degree to these purifying, comforting, and honorable views of God, that they take from us our Father in heaven and substitute for him a being whom we cannot love if we would, and whom we ought not to love if we could. We cannot bow before a being, however great and powerful, who governs tyrannically." In other words, the Unitarians made their worship of God conditional on his being what they wanted him to be. It was a not-so-subtle shift from the objective to the subjective, a warning that if God was not what they thought he ought to be, they'd create a God who was. When man creates God, he reverses the divine process and ends up worshiping self. The Calvinists drew their knowledge of God from the Bible. Their desire was to know God as he is, not as we mortals would like him to be. The Bible has established the objective reality of God in a way that cannot be disputed. By denying that truth, the Unitarians embarked on a course of error that has led this nation into the moral anarchy and spiritual bankruptcy we have today. As for the nature of man, The Unitarians decided that man was not only not innately depraved, but that he was basically good and rational. Indeed, he was even perfectible. But how was that perfectibility to be attained? And how was one to explain man's evil behavior? The Unitarians believed that evil was caused by ignorance, poverty, social injustice, and other environmental and social factors. Education, the Unitarians decided, is the only way to solve the problem of evil. Education would eliminate ignorance, which would then eliminate poverty, which would then eliminate social injustice, which would eliminate crime. They believe that moral progress is as attainable as material progress once the principles of improvement are discovered. In this scheme of things, there was no place for a triune God or a divine Christ through whom salvation was attainable. It was therefore only natural that the Unitarians would shift their practice of religion from the worship and glorification of a harmless, benevolent, fatherly God of limited powers to the creation of earthly institutions to improve the character of man. The one institution that the Unitarians decided could be used to carry out this formidable task was the public school. Why only public schools and not private or charity schools? Because private schools were run and controlled by individuals and denominations that might have entirely different views concerning the nature of man. Besides, private owners were forced by economic reality to concentrate on teaching skills rather than forming character. As for the denominational schools, they were too sectarian, and the charity schools were usually run by Calvinists. Only government schools could become that secular instrument of salvation. Unitarianism has evolved into the humanism that now dominates American public education. But there were other influences that helped change America's Christian consciousness to a secular one. The two most powerful were Owenite socialism and Hegelianism. Owenism was founded by Robert Owen, who was born in England in 1771 and is today considered the father of modern socialism. Owen, who became a wealthy, self-made textile manufacturer, explained how he rejected religion and became a socialist in this way. Quote, "It was with the greatest reluctance and after long contests in my mind that I was compelled to abandon my first and deep-rooted impressions in favor of Christianity, but being obliged to give up my faith in this sect, I was at the same time compelled to reject all others, for I had discovered that all had been based on the same absurd imagination, that each one formed his own qualities, determined his own thoughts, will, and action, and was responsible for them to God and his fellow men. My own reflections compelled me to come to very different conclusions. My reason taught me that I could not have made one of my own qualities, that they were forced upon me by nature, that my language, religion, and habits were forced upon me by society, that nature gave the qualities and society directed them. Thus I was forced, through seeing the error of their foundation, to abandon all belief in every religion which had been taught to man. But my religious feelings were immediately replaced by the spirit of universal charity, not for a sect or a party, or for a color, or for a country or a color, but for the human race, and with a real and ardent desire to do them good." See, Robert Owen was the original do-gooder. By 1813, Owen was ready to embark on a messianic mission to change the world by getting rid of the two obstacles to mankind's happiness, religion and private property. Since he believed that all men were the products of their culture, he decided that education was the only means by which men could attain that happy utopian state on earth. Children are, Owen wrote, without exception, passive and wonderfully contrived compounds, which by an accurate previous and subsequent attention, founded on a correct knowledge of the subject, may be formed collectively to have any human character. And although these compounds, like all other works of nature, possess endless varieties, yet they partake of that plastic quality which by perseverance under judicious management may be ultimately molded into the very image of rational wishes and desires. Unquote. Note the similarities and differences between Owen's views and those of today's behaviorists. Owen believed that children are passive compounds that can be molded like clay. The behaviorists use operant conditioning to produce the desired behavior. Owen believed in molding character. The behaviorists believe in controlling behavior. To Owen, children were clay. To the behaviorists, children are animals. Owen lived at a time when men still believed in the perfectibility of character. Today, the behaviorists are less sanguine. They believe that man's basic character cannot be changed and that scientific control of behavior is the answer. Owen's views about education were welcomed by the Unitarians, for Owen had also advocated the creation of a national education system to mold the character of an entire nation. He wrote in 1813, quote, "It follows that every state, to be well governed, ought to direct its chief attention to the formation of character, and that the best governed state will be that which shall possess the best national system of education. Under the guidance of minds competent to its direction, a national system of education and training, an education may be formed to become the most safe, easy, effectual, and economical instrument of government that can be devised. And it may be made to possess a power equal to the accomplishment of the most grand and beneficial purposes." Unquote. There you have the whole idea of a state education system that can mold an entire nation in the manner that you want it to be molded. Of course, that's the system that now exists in every communist country in the world and also existed in Nazi Germany. In 1825, Robert Owen came to America to establish his communist colony at New Harmony, Indiana. It was called an experiment in social reform through cooperation and rational education. But in less than 2 years, it failed. The problem, Owen decided, was that people raised and educated under the old system were incapable of adapting themselves to the communist way of life, no matter how much they professed to believe in it. Therefore, the Owenites decided that rational education would have to precede the creation of a socialist society. And they subsequently launched a strong campaign to promote a national system of secular education in America. Thus, by 1829, the Unitarians were joined by the Owenites in the new growing movement for secular public education. A third important factor in the growth of the public school movement was the philosophy of Hegelianism, developed in Prussia by George Friedrich Hegel during the early part of the 19th century. Hegel denied the existence of an objectively real God who existed apart from the universe he created, capable of forming a covenant with human beings. Hegel considered Jehovah to be a mythological figure and Christ to have been a non-divine human being. Hegel's view was that God is everything that exists, all-inclusive, and that everything in the universe is in one way or another a manifestation of God. This concept is known as pantheism and is the basis of most Eastern religions. Hegel said that the universe is nothing more than God's mind or spirit or energy in the process of achieving its own perfection or self-realization. Hegel saw history as an evolutionary process of dialectical idealism heading toward perfection. To Hegel, man's mind is a microcosm of the divine mind and the highest manifestation of God in the universe. Man is divinity becoming aware of itself, and therefore man's institutions were the manifestation of divinity itself. Hegel considered the state to be God on earth because it embodied man's collective power and will. From 1850 to about 1890, Hegelian ideas dominated America's top public educators. They believed that the purpose of life was not the glorification of God, but the glorification of man and his state. These were the men who molded public education until it was ready to be taken over by the progressives at the turn of the century. The progressives were a new breed of educator who rejected Christianity and put their faith in science, evolution, and psychology. Science provided the means of understanding the universe. Evolution explained our animal origins. And psychology suggested a new scientific means of controlling human behavior. The progressives are also socialists. Why? Because to them, socialism offered the only acceptable means of dealing with human evil. They were convinced that evil was caused by social injustice, which was in turn caused by our horrible economic and social system. Capitalism, private property, individualism, the Judeo-Christian religious system. The progressives became obsessed with a messianic mission to change America from a free enterprise, individualistic, believing nation into a socialist, collectivist, atheist nation. They knew that Americans were not about to overthrow their way of life for socialism, so they decided that the best way to change America would be through the evolutionary process of education. But to do so, they realized that a new curriculum would be needed for the schools. So John Dewey got to work in his laboratory school at the University of Chicago, and after 2 years came up with the new curriculum. He explained it all in his little book, School and Society. Dewey said that what we had to do was de-emphasize and play down the academic and literacy skills and put the emphasis on the social skills, that is, social studies, activities, values, and behavior. In this way, children amenable to socialism would be produced. As far as the progressives were concerned, the schools would have to reflect the new atheistic purpose of life, the denial of God and the Bible, the sacrifice of man on the altar of collectivism. Now, why did the progressives want to downgrade literacy skills? Well, because to John Dewey and his colleagues, high literacy was considered an obstacle to socialism. Why? Because high literacy produced individuals with independent intelligence who could stand on their own two feet and think. But in a socialist society, an elite does the thinking for everyone else. Thus, a socialist society cannot tolerate a population of individualists who can think for themselves and possibly oppose the elite. And so it was decided to dumb down the American people in order to create a more docile, manipulable population. Now, how were the educators to carry out this plan? How were they to give American parents the impression that they were educating the children while at the same time dumbing them down? Well, these men were the nation's top educators and the world's top psychologists. They put their minds together and came up with an ingenious solution. All they had to do was change the way American children were taught to read. And so they threw out the alphabetic phonics method, which is the proper way to teach children to read an alphabetic writing system, and put in a new method, a whole word, look, say, or sight method that teaches children to read English as if it were Chinese, an ideographic writing system. And this is exactly what they did. The change was made on a wide scale in the early 1930s. The results have been dramatic and devastating. American literacy today is on a par with many undeveloped countries. The dumbing down process has been successfully carried out, and there is no indication that the process can be reversed in the public school. This is something that citizens must realize. The process cannot be reversed in the public schools because the public education system is controlled by the behavioral psychologists. They will not be budged. There isn't a single education reform bill that includes a reform of the teaching of reading. Just look them over, read them over. That is why parents are now removing their children from the public schools and placing them in private schools, church schools, or educating them at home. There is also another reason why Christians abandoned Christian schools, or why Americans abandoned Christian schools in favor of secular public schools. Back in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, there arose a great fear among American Protestants that massive Catholic immigration would change the Protestant character of American society. And so many conservative Protestants joined the Unitarians, Socialists, and Hegelians in promoting a government system of education which could be used to promote Protestant objectives. The Catholics, of course, caught on to this plan and finally decided to create a parochial school system of their own. There were many conservative Protestants who realized that they were taking a great risk in putting their children in secular schools, the risk that the religious faith of their children might be undermined. But they felt that the risk was worth taking. Indeed, they said as much in a report they made to the Policymaking General Association of Massachusetts in 1849, the leading Protestant body in America. They wrote, quote, "The benefits of this system in offering instruction to all," that meant the public school system, "are so many and so great that its religious deficiencies, especially since they can be otherwise supplied," what they meant was by Sunday school in that moment, "do not seem to be a sufficient reason for abandoning it and adopting in place of it a system of denominational parochial school." They made a provision, but this was provisionary. They said, "If after a full and faithful experiment, it should at last be seen that fidelity to the religious interests of our children forbids a further patronage of the system, we can unite with the evangelical Christians in the establishment of private schools in which more full doctrinal religious instruction may be possible. I believe we can say without fear of contradiction that the public schools have been given a full and faithful test." A test lasting over 100 years. And they have failed. The movement of Christians out of the government schools is an eloquent indication that Christians have recognized that failure. It is obvious that America abandoned Christian schools in favor of government secular schools because it no longer believed in the efficacy of salvation through Jesus Christ and accepted salvation through education. The public schools replaced Christ as the instrument of salvation. But the public school has in fact become the instrument of satanic destruction. There is no better way to describe it. That old deluder Satan, who could not delude our Puritan founding fathers, has managed to delude most of their sinful descendants. The choice for Christians today is quite clear. They cannot continue to put their children in satanic schools if they wish to preserve the values, the unalienable rights derived from God, on which this nation's origin is based and on which its future survival depends. America abandoned its early Christian schools for the wrong reasons. It must now get back to them for the right reasons. The purpose of life is still and will always be the glorification of God. And the function of education, in the words of R.J. Rushdoony, is the preparation of man to glorify God, to enjoy Him, and to serve Him in and through a chosen calling. This is the knowledge we should be imparting to our children at home or in school. That is the only way we shall be able to preserve the priceless heritage of our freedom, or the freedom our founding fathers bequeathed us. Thank you.
Very economical with our time tonight, and I think we will use it by offering to have some questions asked and answered by Mr. Blumenfeld. So if someone has a intriguing question, I'll hear it and then repeat it into the speaker system. I'd like to stand and ask one. What is the most current issue between you and the National Education Association?
Well, the most current issue is that they don't like me. That's the first thing. But I think that my book has been out 2 years already, and they show no indication of going anywhere except in the direction that they said they intended to go. They've only confirmed everything I said in my book about them. In fact, things have gotten worse. Their battle against Christianity is really becoming quite intense. They've joined forces with People for the American Way. And I think we're going to see a very interesting campaign in this coming election. The NEA has now become probably the strongest single political force in the United States, strongest single organized political force in the United States, outside the two political parties, and they have much more money than any of the political parties. I will discuss some of this in my workshop tomorrow. I think the workshop's tomorrow.
Okay. Is it an option to attempt to get good people on the school board, to take over the school board, and to have an influence on public schools that way? Is it redeemable through that method?
Well, this is my opinion. I believe that getting elected to school boards is really a waste of time. And I'll tell you why. Christians should be busy building Christian institutions, not saving humanist institutions. You see, getting on a school board means that you simply have to deal with all the problems of the NEA and the reading problem and all of that, and usually the majority are liberal. The majority of the school board is going to be made up of liberals. You're going to be outvoted, you're going to be frustrated, and after 5 or 10 years, you're going to throw up your hands and say, this won't work. Now, as a matter of fact, a couple of months ago when I was in the state of Washington, another, and I was accompanied by a conservative who had been elected to a school board in his small area. And he wanted my advice on certain things, on certain matters. The horrible thing was that this man was totally ignorant of what's going on. Totally ignorant. So what good is it to be a conservative on the school board if you have no knowledge of what's going on? He didn't even know what methods they were using in teaching reading in his school district. He didn't know how to deal with the curriculum. Well, I could advise him in an hour of traveling by car, but the problem is that conservatives who generally run for school boards know very little about what's going on. And so they have really no way of making any input. And then usually they're dealing with all of these humanists that staff the schools. How do they deal with these humanists? All they're doing really, the humanists simply find ways to get around what the conservatives want to do. Well, I'm saying that we have limited resources, limited energies, and it is best for us at this time, knowing what we know about the public education system and how completely controlled it is by the behavioral psychologists and the humanists, from the very top, your graduate schools of education, the writers of your textbooks, how completely controlled it is, that there's absolutely no way it can be turned around by Christians. It's much better for Christians to devote their energies to building Christian schools where they can give the children the education that they want their children to have, instead of having to beg a public school to throw a few crumbs to the Christians.
We can withdraw our children from the public system, but how can we withdraw our financial support from that system?
Well, I've been advising Christians to form a class action suit, go to court and simply tell the court, look, it's unjust for Christians to be forced to pay for atheist education. I mean, let's put this on the table. Do we or do we not have religious freedom in this country? I mean, let's bring it before the court. Say, should Christians be forced to support atheist, humanist education when atheists are not forced to support Christian education? What makes the atheists so privileged, so special, that only they are eligible for full monies from the government, full funding by the taxpayer? Everyone must pay taxes to pay for atheist education in this country. That's unjust. That's unfair. And I think if Christians will go to court on this issue, that they would have a very good case. You can certainly get in the newspaper.
Go ahead. Christian schools, private schools are expensive. For some, it may not be an option. In some cases, homeschooling is also expensive, or people don't feel competent to do it. What are the alternatives you can do if you don't have the money? Should mom go to work?
Well, I suppose every family has to face that problem, you know, individually. Every family has a different situation. You just have to ask yourself, how important is it for my child or my children to get a decent education, a good Christian education? Then you have to do what you've got to do. You see, to put children in the public schools today is really sentencing them to a horror. When Dr. Rushdoony said at the end of his speech that humanistic education teaches the love of death, he's not kidding. They teach death education in the schools, you know. All over this country. Why do you think we've had this teenage epidemic? Suicides. As a matter of fact, here in Minnesota recently, you had in the Minneapolis area, a youngster committed suicide. The first suicide in that particular high school. He hung himself in his classroom. And educators all over the country are asking, why are these youngsters committing suicide? You know why they're committing suicide? Because the public schools are teaching two things that when joined together are like an atomic bomb. They're lethal. They teach the child to hate life, and then they teach them to love death. Now, how do they teach the hatred of life? Well, they teach in values clarification that in life you have to decide who to throw out of the lifeboat, your grandmother or your sister. There are an awful lot of children who, when they're given that problem and are told that that's what real life is all about, choosing who among your loved ones to kill, they become rather upset. They're also taught in school that there is no God, there is no salvation, there is no heaven, there is no hell. They have no souls. Anyone who has to face that kind of a life must indeed come to the conclusion that life is pretty unbearable. How can you love a life in which you have to choose between which loved one to kill? But then they teach the child about death. They have the child write his own obituaries. They take the child to on field trips to cemeteries and funeral parlors. Some of the kids try out the coffins. They write suicide notes. They discuss death at great length. And pretty soon the kids have gained a very friendly feeling about death. That death is an easy way out. We have one high school about 50 miles west of Boston, in the town of Lemonster, where they've had something like a dozen suicides in the last few years. So I visited that school to find out what is going on there. And I asked the principal, do you teach death education? He said, of course we do. He was very proud of it. Oh, it's very necessary these days. And I said, well, who was teaching your death education? And he told me, well, it was the health education teachers are teaching about death education. So I said, well, can I see one of these can I interview one of your health education teachers? And so he said yes, and I met the young man. He must have been in his late 30s or early 40s. He'd been in that high school for over, I suppose, 12, 15 years, teaching health education and death education and suicide. And I asked him what textbook he used, and he showed me this textbook for Random House. Regular big fat textbook, beautifully illustrated, that has everything in it. Everything, including a nice big spread on suicide. And the youngster who had just committed suicide in that school had been on, he had coached that youngster in track. And I asked him, well, why did that youngster commit suicide? Nobody knows. As a matter of fact, the youngsters who are committing suicide are the good children. Very sensitive children. There's nothing wrong with them. They're not druggies. They're not on alcohol. They're not drinking. They're usually good, very good, sensitive kids who are loved by their families. It has nothing to do with their not being loved, that they are truly loved by them. It's because they are loved that they feel so terrible that they may have to choose between killing someone and their family. So I asked this teacher, I said, well, in view of the record of this school, I said, you think things are going to get better or worse? And he said, well, what do you mean by better or worse? Well, I said, by better I mean fewer suicides or no suicides. He said, well, that's a matter of opinion, what's better or what's worse. You see, the fact that children are consciously choosing suicide means that the courses are working. They are getting the message. They're being told that suicide is a rational option. And some of them are taking it so. The teacher is saying, gee, these kids are really learning what we're teaching. You have to do whatever you can to save your child from that kind of a school. I don't care what you have to do, whether you have to go to work or get a second mortgage or sell the second car or whatever. You cannot in good conscience put your child in that kind of an atmosphere and expect...
I think we're going to take advantage of this break to halt for adjournment this evening. We're close to our adjournment time. We want to be able to get back in good time tomorrow morning. So, Mr. Blumenfeld, thank you.